Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Guy McPherson, and I'm going solo for the first time on Nature Bats Last. Welcome to the Progressive Radio Network. This is Nature Bats Last. It's NBL on PRN.FM. Typically, I start with stories beyond the mainstream. I'll get to two of those in a moment. First, though, I'm compelled to respond to the nasty email messages I've been receiving about the theme song for this show. The show was written and recorded by a South African man. It's posted at SoundCloud.com under his moniker, AfraZen. That's Afra, as in Africa, and Zen, as in Zen Buddhism. So Afra Zen wrote and recorded Nature Bats Last, and just to be clear, I think it's great. Now I want to say that again, just to make sure you know what I mean. I think the song is great. It's a catchy tune that captures the essence of my message in 3 minutes. Check it out at SoundCloud. Listen until you can't get it out of your head, especially if you don't like it. And stop telling me you don't like it. If your taste in music doesn't match mine, one of us has issues. And it surely can't be me. Onward then, through the fog, with two stories from beyond the mainstream. From yesterday on countercurrents.org comes a story by Nicholas C. Arjumbau. And I'm pretty sure I mispronounced that last name. My apologies. It's headlined, "Who owns the nukes? If Wall Street owns the government, maybe it's time to take back the government." Well, personally, I think it's a few decades too late for that, and that any attempt to govern large numbers of people is misguided. I'm with desert anarchist Edward Abbey on this one. Quote, "Anarchism is not a romantic fable, but the hard-headed realization based on 5,000 years of experience that we cannot entrust the management of our lives to kings, priests, politicians, generals, and county commissioners," end quote. That quote from Abbey reminds me, a contemporary of Abbey's died 3 days ago, journalist Charles Bowden, was 69 years old and living in Las Cruces, New Mexico. He was known for his honest, hard-edge, apocalyptic writing, for which he became famous when he was living in Tucson, Arizona. It's written up in all the major media outlets within the last few days. The second story from beyond the mainstream appeared at antiwar.com and consortiumnews.com, although I picked it up on zerohedge.com, where it ran yesterday under the title, "Ex-NSA Director, U.S. Intelligence Veterans Write Open Letter to Merkel to Avoid All-Out Ukraine War." It includes these excerpts. William Binney, the former senior NSA crypto-mathematician who back in March 2012 blew the whistle on the NSA's spying programs more than a year before Edward Snowden, took the unusual step of sending the following memo, dated August 30th, to German Chancellor Merkel, challenging the reliability of Ukrainian and U.S. media claims about a Russian invasion. "The undersigned are longtime veterans of U.S. intelligence. We take the unusual step of writing this open letter to you to ensure that you have an opportunity to be briefed on our views prior to the NATO summit on September 4th and 5th. You need to know, for example, that accusations of a major Russian invasion of Ukraine appear not to be supported by reliable intelligence. Rather, the intelligence," in quotes, "seems to be of the same dubious, politically fixed kind used 12 years ago to justify the U.S.-led attack on Iraq. We saw no credible evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq then. We see no credible evidence of a Russian invasion now. Consider Iraq today, worse than catastrophic. Although President Vladimir Putin has until now showed considerable reserve on the conflict in the Ukraine, it behooves us to remember that Russia, too, can shock and awe. In our view, if there is the slightest chance of that kind of thing eventually happening in Europe because of Ukraine, sober-minded leaders need to think this through very carefully. We're teetering on the edge here. If that's not enough dire news for you, those two stories from beyond the mainstream, Lindsay Morrison does her typically stellar job breaking hopium. Here's Lindsay with a minute plus breaking hopium at NatureBat's Last.
Well, folks, it certainly looks like mankind has screwed the pooch, and that is hard to deal with, but we tend to give reptiles a free pass of innocence because they're hardwired with instinct. They don't have to grapple with the agony of choice. We, on the other hand, feel like evolution's little orphans floating in space, longing for the guidance of parents through gods or kings or institutions. We grew attached through a social survival mechanism that evolved in periods of abundance which allowed for longer childhoods. Parents needed an incentive to keep hauling babies around, and we experienced this prolonged attachment as a bond called love. Love has driven us crazy. We have cooked up all these reasons for our urge to be the big kahuna and not die, just like everything wants to be the big kahuna and not die. So we try to impose ideals of justice, democracy, safety, and comfort on the cold vacuum of space, and though we have not been able to give up our temporary coping devices in time to straighten the course, who is to say this is not enough? In songs and art and novels and cathedrals, we tried to convey the wild fears, desires, and pleasures of being an animated phenomenon of nature. I'm glad to be a witness to it and to be able to hear love songs like This Magic Moment by the Drifters. To quote, sweeter than wine, softer than a summer night, everything I want I have whenever I hold you tight. This magic moment while your lips are close to mine will last forever, forever till the end of time. That's how I feel about it this week anyway. Good luck and goodbye.
Thanks, Lindsay. That's great, as always. Each week we seek out a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo in their rhetoric or analysis, but also provides insightful and useful information to the issues at hand. Doomer of the Week this week is Dave Warren. Dave is from the Washington, D.C. area, and he sent these lines in a private message via Facebook. Quote, your message is hauntingly beautiful in a way. The way of loons skimming low at dusk while swans coo and snuggle and sing in low murmurs the lament of a species and the fragile web of life it is taking with it. Thanks for that bit of beautiful writing, Dave. Much appreciated. Dave Warren from Washington, D.C. Calls are welcome during the latter portion of tonight's show as I interview Pauline Schneider about her efforts to document my work. Please hold your calls until we're well into the interview. Pauline has created a film and more products are in the works. In fact, just today she posted a musical montage based on her year following me as I delivered presentations. Pauline, thanks for joining me on NatureBat's Last on the Progressive Radio Network. How about that montage? Let's start with that.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me. This is really great. I'm really excited. The montage, oh, it was a year in the making. it was a lot of fun. And what you see is a roll of all of the towns, states, and even countries that you visited, many of which I was also able to join you on. I didn't get to go everywhere you went, I'm happy to say. I think Winnipeg was out for me, especially when it was colder than Mars. I was really kind of glad to miss out on that one.
Yeah, Winnipeg in February is not your one of your popular tourist destinations.
No, and not my cup of tea. But I really enjoyed going to all these other wonderful new places that most of them I had not been to.
So the montage includes a year's worth of work, many presentations that you recorded. In a few cases, the recording was provided by somebody else, and the theme music is the theme music for this program. It's NatureBat's Last by Afra Zen, which
right.
You can find at SoundCloud.
I usually clean. I use the clean version.
Yes.
I noticed tonight there was a different version.
I noticed tonight there was a different version than usual. I guess the FCC policy has been relaxed just for us.
Right. Well, it should be interesting. We'll see what happens.
Now that montage includes toward the end. I think it was in April. I was based in New York and visited Canada and a couple of other places in upstate New York. Tell us a little bit about that experience. I delivered a presentation at Rhode Island, for example. And you recorded me in conversation with climate scientist Paul Beckwith at Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about that just a little bit with me, if you would.
Sure, absolutely. That was your East Coast tour that we started planning a couple months in advance. Actually, I think more. It took quite a bit of, really figuring out how we were going to arrange it, set things up. And people started coming out of the woodwork offering their homes, offering venues, and before we knew it, we had a stacked schedule. And you were basically on tour for 21 days straight. And we went from New York, Westchester County, which is an hour north of Manhattan. So you did some things in Westchester County. You did a couple of things in the city. You met Gary Null at PRN, which is an amazing radio station, absolutely phenomenal. You got to tour the city a little bit, and then we traveled upstate to Sempronius, where we, got to meet some amazing people up there. You had a wonderful conversation with a house full of people, with Wendy Bandersky-Miller. It was great fun. And then we drove up through Niagara up into Canada, which I had never been to Canada. Now, I've lived on three continents, and I've never been to Canada, so it was a really new experience for me, and it was a lot of fun. Driving through the border was amazing into Canada. It just was so pleasant, and it felt so normal. Coming back was a little bit different. I don't know if you remember that.
Of course, I always remember when I come back into this country. Because there's a lot.
I was amazed by the camera surveillance. There were dozens of cameras on the U.S. side coming back in, and there was nothing on the Canadian side going into Canada. Do we live in a police state, do you think?
Yes, we absolutely live in a police state.
Okay, I was just wondering.
A police surveillance state.
Yes. Well, Canada was wonderful, and you had several events there. The amazing people set up incredible venues for you. We met Paul Beckwith almost immediately. He actually showed up outside of Ottawa, which is where he lives. He came to what was the first town that we were in? Perth.
Perth.
Perth, right. And our friend John there had set that up. That was wonderful and a great little venue. It was a wonderful turnout. And we went to Ottawa, where you and Paul had this day-long conversation and walk in this. To me, it felt like Mars, the temperature. It was so cold. I was freezing. And I had to, I had to grin and bear it with the camera. And luckily, the camera grinned and bared it, too.
Well, it wasn't all fun and games on the East Coast tour, as it turns out.
Yes.
We got some particularly bad news.
We did. On our way back to New York, I will never forget that call. It was you were checking your messages, and you had gotten a call.
I didn't have cell service.
No.
I was in Canada. Because I have a Hello Goodbye phone that doesn't do a lot of stuff.
Right. And we both heard that message together, and it was very, you could hear it. It was Mike Rupert, calling you, and you could hear it in his voice, and he said, I need a buddy to talk to, man, you know, and it just, you could hear it in his voice that he was suffering, and you tried to call him, and I don't know if you got through ever.
Well, he finally managed to connect with me for just a few minutes when I was speaking on the campus of the University of Rhode Island.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And that was the day before he died. We talked for just 3 minutes and 48 seconds.
Wow.
And he called to tell me that he loved me and that he respected my work. And I didn't know he was saying goodbye, obviously. But that's what it amounted to. And I realized that when I found out a couple of days later that he had committed suicide.
Yeah, that was terrible. It was terrible to lose a friend. I'd never met him, nor had I ever spoken with him. But I had, you know, Facebooked with him. And I had hoped and expected that eventually on one of these travels we would end up, you know, meeting him somewhere. And you know, I feel really sad that I'm not going to get to meet him. And I feel like we, you know, we lost a champion.
Yes. Yes, we did. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the beginning.
Yeah.
How did you come across my work? Where did this all get started?
Well, I mentioned this in the documentary because it's kind of, a lot of people know about you, and they've known about you for a while, but I didn't know anything about you. I'd never heard of you. And actually, I had seen a little clip of you in a documentary about college and what a trap it is.
College conspiracy put together by the National Inflation Association, I think it's called.
Right. So I had seen you in that, and I remember, you know, you saying that you graduate from college with a mortgage and you don't even get the house. And I thought, this guy knows what he's talking about. And that was, you know, that's, I didn't remember that I had seen that until long after I'd gotten to meet you. And what happened was you were planning to come down to the Age of Limits conference. And my transition friends and I were also planning on going down there. And I guess they knew you and you had connected with them. And I guess that was Cameron Kelly and Susan Rubin. And they had arranged for some venues for you here in Westchester. So we quickly pulled together, you know, all our contacts, and we had a wonderful turnout for you at the Mount Kisco Library.
Yes, packed the Mount Kisco Public Library. That was a great response.
Never underestimate women who really mean business. We packed that place, and you brought the house down, literally.
And you prepared for that by watching another video clip, so you could do a little homework.
I watched your Muskegon presentation.
Right,
and
Muskegon Community College, and I heard from the woman who arranged that event just a few days ago that it's been viewed more than 31,000 times.
That's amazing.
All over the world, so.
Well, it's a wonderful video, and you did it. You really address in that presentation the social justice aspect and, you know, people taking control of their lives and embracing life in a beautiful way. But that was before you realized there was a climate change component as serious as it is now. You were talking about collapse, which is
In February 2012, I was still speaking about collapse of industrial civilization.
Right.
And so that's the presentation you saw was all about collapse of industrial civilization, not about collapse of our climate system. And I assume those 31,000 views, I know that you incorporated some of that video in your film, Going Dark.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that 30,000 of those views weren't you getting that piece.
Well, you never know. I did watch it a few times. It's an amazing video, and it really reinforced the work that I had been doing for the past 3 years in the transition movement locally, and also in the work that I had been doing for several years, trying to learn how to grow my own food and to have a smaller footprint and to use less fossil fuels. A lot of people always talk about renewables and more efficiency and rarely talk about just use less, you know. You don't become more efficient at eating to lose weight. You just eat less and then
right.
You lose weight. So it's the same thing, you know, with fossil fuels. You just want to use less. And, of course, right now we should try to use none. That's impossible because of the culture we've created around us. It's nearly impossible to not use fossil fuels unless you do a radical life change like you have done.
Well, and that's right. If you live in a city, if you depend upon grocery stores for your food, if you depend upon municipal water coming out of your taps, all of those require fossil fuels to maintain the system
right. That
enables those.
Exactly. But to some degree, so before I, you know, when I saw this video, and it seemed that you also had the same thinking, is if we prepare, we will be able to ride this out. We know it's going to be warmer, climate change is coming, you know, and we know collapse is coming. Absolutely, there's no question. We're in collapse. It's a grinding, slow, agonizing collapse, but it's here. But if we educate ourselves and we prepare and we're thoughtful and we create communities that are also aware, it might be easier to do this collapse. Unfortunately, when, you know, I love the bit in the video. It's not an apocalypse. It's an adventure. I just love that. I think we should all wear T-shirts that say that. Although it is going to end up being more of an apocalypse.
It looks like we've moved on.
It's not an apocalypse. It's an adventure. Oh, wait.
Halcyon days of an adventure, and now it's an apocalypse.
Right, right. Yes, exactly. So when I saw you speak at this library, which is, 7 minutes down the street from me, I was knocked back on my heels, as it was everyone else in the room. And we immediately went for drinks across the street. It was quite devastating, the news you laid on us, because it was very different from what you had said in that video, which was really hopeful and empowering and just like, be yourself, be your individual human being. And you were also, I think, in the library in Mount Kisco, you were also reeling from this information that you were starting to get.
Well, right. It had only been 6 or 7 months earlier that the message had changed quite radically, that instead of collapse of industrial civilization being the greatest issue facing our species, instead it became about climate change. Because, Tim Garrett wrote in his paper in Climatic Change, which was published in 2009 and actually written in 2007, he wrote then that only collapse of industrial civilization, collapse of civilization generally,
right. Only
collapse prevents runaway climate change. Well, at the time, there wasn't any reported self-reinforcing feedback loops in the refereed journal literature. And since then, we've learned about nearly 40 of them being reported in very reliable sources. And it's becoming abundantly clear that the clathrate gun has been fired with all sorts of evidence all over the place. So yeah, it's not merely an adventure anymore. It's not all fun and games. It's not merely collapse of industrial civilization, which would reduce the human population by a very, very large percentage on the planet. But instead, it's the apocalypse. It's abrupt climate change that is underway, and on track to cause us to lose habitat as a species. So that's a big change for any of us to make in a relatively short period of time. So at the time you heard me speak in April of 2013, about a year and a half ago, I was still grappling with the message myself and presenting it really rather poorly. I was the medical doctor who has a really poor bedside manner.
Several people said those exact words.
Yeah, I mean, I was the scientist who goes up and presents the science and says, oh, and I gotta go. I got a class to teach, so film at 11, you know, and I just walk out without exhibiting any empathy for my fellow humans at all. I was a horrible human being. I'm still undoubtedly a horrible human being. I'm a civilized white man after all. But
you're no more horrible than the rest of us. We're all in the same horrible boat.
My message was poorly delivered at that time compared to what I've learned more recently in any event. Well, anyway, let's backtrack just a little bit and tell us a little bit about your experience.
Right. What happened when I heard that, I pretty much shut down. I mean, we came down, Cameron and I drove down to Pennsylvania with you to
second annual Age of Limits Conference.
The Age of Limits Conference, which was, really exciting. There were so many amazing speakers there and people, John Michael Greer, who I really admired and I've read many of his books and I really respected his work. And we had a nerd fest, the two of us, let me tell you. We were just complete, two nerds outside of a conference. We can't sit still for too long, so we just stood there by a tree and just talked nerd conversation for over an hour. It was ridiculous. And in that conversation, as an aside, a very funny thing happened because Cameron and I had started sort of, we were like your acolytes in a sense, following you around and just really listening to what you had to say and listening to your conversations with everyone. He began to call us your dire wolves. And let me tell you, we felt very protective of you, even though you knocked us on our heels as well. There's a great deal of rethinking going on and a lot of emotional introspection we had to really do, considering that we both have children and we have, she has grandchildren and I hoped someday to have grandchildren and I may still, which might not be the best thing, but what happens, and we're all going into the abyss, and we're all going together, regardless. I became incredibly depressed for about a month. I really had a hard time getting out of bed and doing things and getting my daughter to school. And I realized after about a month of crying and grieving that I can't just keep doing that. And I had to find the gem in this. And, there's always something good that you can find. My mother died of cancer. She died of breast cancer 24 years ago. And she never came to grips with her impending death. Every day she was getting better, according to her. And she was not even close. And I really wish that she had embraced her impending abyss, because then she might have had more honest conversations with us. And it would have been a more genuine communication. I mean, we missed out on a lot of chances to connect and to learn secrets that she took with her to her grave that we had to find out later on. And it's a shame, you know, if we can accept that we are going into the abyss, it might change the way we decide to live these last few years. I had a dear friend who died of ALS several years ago, and I watched him transform from a very physically powerful, handsome man at the top of the world in advertising, just, you know, rocking it, amazing, to a frail, physically frail, physically weak man, but a soul, his soul just blossomed inside of him. It was the light of love that came out of his eyes, and the wisdom that just came out of him just was transformative. Anybody who met him, they were transformed instantly because he realized that his time was limited and that there were amazing things he could still do with what time he had left. And he worked to educate people on ALS and to raise funds to help people who had ALS live lives of quality that they had left. And he really touched so many people's lives. And I think that those are lessons that if we can take in this situation, this is going to touch everybody's lives. Climate change.
Right.
And
it already is touching a lot of people's lives.
Yeah. And we can choose to pretend it's not going to happen or that some techno-fantasy fix is going to make it all go away. Or a phone app, which is something that, I mean, literally it has been mentioned by the government agencies working on climate, working to slow climate change, which, you know, they're not really working on it. I just don't think that any of those things really address the reality of the situation we're in. I really don't. And I think that we need to come up with our own solutions, our own personal solutions, looking at this reality and getting together with people who do also get it, even if they're just on Facebook. You know,
a lot of
people are isolated and they don't have that community. They're married to people. They're having relationships with people who don't get it.
Yes. Yes, that's true. Yeah, the Tim Garrett's work makes it quite clear that civilization is a heat engine and that creating civilized, quote, solutions to a problem resulting from civilization is not going to help. There's no app for that.
Right.
And so, yes, we're headed into the abyss, and there are people who are unwilling to take on the information. This goes to a question I wanted to ask you. There are people who are unable or unwilling to absorb this information. And you know, you see the groups all the time, you see the individuals all the time. I can't identify any common denominators about these people. So how come? How come you seem to grok it right away? and so many other people can't. I mean, it's a relatively rare person I come across who says, yeah, that science makes sense. We're headed for a temperature. The temperature is already locked into place based on this 40-year lag between carbon dioxide emissions and temperature rise. Temperature is already locked into place beyond which humans have ever existed before, which suggests that we won't have habitat for humans. So I get that, you know. Some people get that. You seem to pick up on that right away. Mm-hmm. So, but other people resist violently mm-hmm. the science-based information mm-hmm. that suggests, that indicates that we won't be around forever. So why are you so strange?
I'm a weirdo. I've always been a weirdo. I tend to grok things. That's if you can grok something, you're definitely a weirdo. I love Heinlein. Oh my God. So I feel like I have a degree in anthropology, and what you do in anthropology is you're kind of a generalist. It's a little bit of this and a little bit of that. There's a little science, there's a little mystery, there's magic, there's biology, there's psychology, there's art, and you piece all these different things together, and you try to build a tapestry of understanding, to understand a person's culture or a people's culture, how they think, how they create their cosmology. Specialists can't do that. You hire a specialist to come in and analyze the fabric of a tapestry, and that's all they're going to look at. They're not going to see the art that went into it. They're not going to think about the man or the woman who grew the fibers and took the time and planted them by moonlight and poured honey into the ground so that they would grow fertile, and then did a dance around the flax so that it would grow strong. That person is not going to think about any of that. They're going to look at the fibers under a microscope, and that's all they're going to see. And I think that's the same for a lot of climate scientists. They see the numbers, but they don't see the big picture. What those numbers mean to living fauna and flora all around the planet. They're scientists, so they have a basic understanding. They have some biology, but that's not their focus. They're seeing numbers. And I think the other thing that prevents people from seeing it is just basic fear. I mean, people still believe in demons. Crying out loud. If you're going to use a demon to explain schizophrenia, then you're afraid of the science. It's brain chemistry. It's not a demonic possession. It's brain chemistry. That's just basic fear of something. If you understand it, you see that it's far more complex. It's not an easy, I'm going to blame the devil and it's his fault and I'll pray. If you have brain chemistry, it's more complicated. It takes more care and more time. And it takes acting like adults and being responsible to address the problem. And people don't just have schizophrenia. It doesn't just arrive magically out of nowhere. There are triggers. It's part of the environment. It's part of their brain chemistry. And we're all part of this. You know, and so it's so much easier just to say, well, this is a demonic possession that caused that person to do those horrible things, rather than it's our culture, our sick culture that doesn't take care of people, that doesn't respect the fragility of our bodies and our minds, and that doesn't see that there are consequences to our negative behavior. You know, we live in a very violent culture that embraces violence and brutality.
I would say not only embraces, but requires. Maintaining the set of living arrangements that we maintain in this country requires imperialism.
Yes.
It requires the bomb and kill.
I went through it yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I mention that?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. So I just came home from Belize. I was in Belize, which is a third world country, but it's freer than the U.S. And we arrived back into the U.S. via Miami International Airport yesterday, and I'm telling you, hundreds of people coming back into our own country were treated like we were all criminals, like we were all about to bomb the airport, or we were all bringing in drugs. And you know, whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty? Or, you know, just how about just basic common sense? Well, you already screened this luggage. Why do you have to screen it three more times and make me miss my connection? Why do you have to, why are you abusing my person this way? Why are you treating my family like we're cattle, like we're animals? It's so dehumanizing.
It's I would argue that that's one of the requirements to maintain an empire in decline,
yes,
is to ensure obedience at home as well as oppression abroad. And that obedience at home means ratcheting up the police state. As long as the government has control over the situation, we will see an increasingly violent police state and an increasingly violent set of military operations.
Yes, yes. Well, when you have the president outraged that a known terrorist group chopped somebody's head off, a reporter, a journalist, who knew he was in a dangerous area in the first place, took that risk on his own, knew he was in a dangerous area, knew he was going to be in a dangerous place with terrorists, your president is outraged about that, but says nothing about a police officer who is a peace officer and is supposed to protect us from criminals, shoots an 18-year-old young male in the back of the head. He's not outraged about that?
So let's go back on track, if you don't mind.
That's empire out of control.
Yes, yes, the empire clearly is out of control to anybody who's paying attention. Unfortunately, I think there are 340 million Americans not paying attention.
Yeah.
In any event, you made this movie, and
yes,
what makes you think you can make a movie? I mean, do you think anybody with a camera can just go out there and make a movie? I understand the technology is profoundly improved relative to where we were just not very long ago.
Yes.
But
yeah, it's tremendously changed. I remember when my dad put a Brownie camera in my hand when I was 5, and I've been taking pictures ever since. And I went to school in Texas. I got a degree in radio and TV production. So, you know, I've been shooting with videotape and film for a while. And I have to say that, you know, I remember playing with film and videotape, and you're splicing and you're cutting, and I gotta say, this new technology is a lot of fun. It's really pretty amazing. And it's changed even in the last 7 years. So I still have some older, you know, older editing software, but the new stuff that's out there is just really a lot of fun. You can get a lot done very quickly, and the quality is just amazing. The video quality is fantastic. It's really exciting, and I think that pretty much anybody who can grab a camera can make and should make a documentary of what they're seeing. It doesn't hurt to watch a lot of documentaries before you do it, because you want to learn how to pace it. You want to learn what looks good. And
also, you had more recent experience, as I recall, in the classroom. Can you tell us about that just a little bit?
In film, with the film
yes,
work?
Yes.
So I was at SUNY Purchase a few years ago, and I took a documentary class, which was really fun. It was back in 1995, not that long ago. But I was living in Ossining at the time, and we were under threat in Ossining, which is along the Hudson River. And there's a tremendous amount of environmental degradation that's gone on over the years along the Hudson River. And we have Indian Point, our big nuclear power plant. We had Con Edison, General Electric dumping, you know, thousands and thousands of gallons of PCBs into the river. And then there was the train station that had a what they called a bog. It was a cesspool, basically, of PCBs that Con Edison had dumped. And it was sort of leaking into the Hudson River, so they wanted to get rid of it by setting up a toxic waste incinerator and burning it on site. And as soon as the League of Women Voters got wind of it, by the way, shout out to League of Women Voters, you're amazing, I love you, rock on. Give, you know, donate, find your local League of Women Voters group and please send them money and support, because they are the real patriots. They alerted the community when the mayors and the local, you know, leaders of the communities were silent. They told us about this, and we all got up in arms, and we made them stop. They unfortunately trucked all that stuff to somebody else's backyard and burnt it somewhere else. But in the process of our fight, I was taking this class, and I was able to shoot a short documentary about it. It's really weird, but it was done by a team of us working on it together. So, you know, it wasn't one person's vision; it was my idea, and then we all worked together and we made it happen. It was a lot of fun, but that was my first real documentary. So maybe I'll upload it sometime, and people can get a view of it. It's pretty funny. Really, really funny to watch. But that was in 1995. Actually, no, 1993. So we were successful in at least in our backyard. Sadly, somebody else got the junk in theirs, and that was our first real experience with the DEC, the Department of Environmental Conservation, which they're not. This white man speak with forked tongue is really, really true. They just are, it's just about making money. It's not really
right.
Cleaning things up.
So we have just a few minutes left for the interview. So if somebody wants to call in with a question or a comment, feel free to call now. The number is 888. This is a toll-free number, 888-874-4888, and we'll continue to talk until we get a question. So, Pauline, you started to have some experience with radio and television, with video production generally, and that experience continues into the current day, and including your documentary class and so on college campuses within the last year or so. Mm-hmm. So what's next? Where do you see yourself turning with your documentary efforts?
Well, I have, over this past year, I've shot hundreds of hours of video. And what I would like to do is, based on that music video, that little, you know, road trip video montage, all the video that I shot, I'd like to create a web documentary where people can click on, you know, that town that we were in and then see, you know, the video that, you know, the events that took place there. So that will be a whole, you know, that'll be a while in the making, because it's a quite a lot of video that was shot. And there's no way to have put it all in 30-minute documentary. But I think that doing it this way, in shorter snippets, you know, more palatable bites, I think it'll be fun to do for me, and also fun for people to go through, especially all the people who hosted you and me, who were just amazing and just incredibly gracious and generous with their homes and their funds. You know, when we were in Canada, they flew us around and they put us up in a beautiful place. They were really, really quite generous. It was really wonderful. Thank
right,
you.
And it happens all the time. I just throw myself into the arms of humanity when I speak. I speak for no charge, and I just show up and people take care of me and feed me and water me and put me in nice places to stay. And it's great when you depend upon the kindness of strangers. And as it turns out, the strangers are kind.
Yeah, they are.
That's lots of fun.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I had a lot of fun with the people. A lot of people were very willing to donate music, and music is really important. So I had Anya Daniels, who was a Facebook friend of yours, and I think you had met her. She, beautiful music, beautiful, beautiful music. And, of course, AfroZen, incredible. And then my friend Franch, she does Kirtan music, so that gives a beautiful background to the film. And then my daughter's song, Stripped, closes it with the credits. I had a lot of fun picking the music out of it. That's putting curtains on, once you're moved into your home and you start picking out the drapes. It's a lot of fun to do that part.
By the way, you might be just a tad biased when it comes to calling your daughter's music quite beautiful.
Yes,
but it is.
I am.
By the way,
but it is. And I'm not the first film that's had her music in it. So her music's already been in a film at the New York Tribeca Film Festival. Yeah.
Speaking of film festivals, tell us a little bit about where Going Dark has been accepted, where it's going to be showing.
Going Dark's going to be showing at Provo, Utah, at the Provo City Library there.
It's the underfunded film festival, as I recall.
Correct. The underfunded film festival. Really, the requirement is 15,000, 10,000, or 5,000, under those. So,
Dollar amount? Are you talking dollar amounts?
Dollar amounts.
Okay.
Correct. Yes, in U.S. dollars. So
okay.
It was a lot of fun to get that notice that it's going to be screened this coming Saturday during the day at the library. So there's a whole bunch of films they're going to be showing. And
so you can go to the website, presumably, of the Underfunded Film Festival and find out where Going Dark is going to be shown on the big screen this coming Saturday in the Provo, Utah vicinity, which is in the Salt Lake City, Provo, Orem metropolitan area.
Yes, and that's uffest.com/schedule. So that's the first place, and it's been submitted to Sundance and to several other film festivals, and now it's just waiting to see, what happens. So it's very exciting. Even if it doesn't get into the finals, a lot of the film festivals will show it. They will screen it to put butts in seats, and that's always fun. And really, it's just important for people to see and to hear, what's not being told to them.
Right. Yes, that's an excellent point. There are a lot of things that the corporate government doesn't necessarily want us to know.
Right. Yes. Yes, that is very true. And I'm not interested in winning anything. I really could care less. I just want people to see it. This isn't about making money or winning awards or anything. It's just about sharing and getting. Helping people through this. The people who get it are going to need more help, I think. And people who don't get it, that's fine. I'm not going to worry about that. People who get it are going to need support. And that was why you and I decided to take that grief recovery workshop. And that was amazing.
And now it's time to wrap. We don't have time to go into that tonight because we need to wrap up.
Let's wrap it up.
So,
thank you so much for having me, Guy.
Thanks very much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. The show wraps, as usual, with a brief update about climate change and a comment from Facebook's Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group. Regarding climate change, you can find all the information, the regularly updated climate change summary and update at guymcpherson.com. Here's the latest awful news, so fresh it's not even been added to the long essay at the blog. A story from the August 31st issue of New Scientist is titled, No More Pause, Warming Will Be Nonstop From Now On. It cites a recent paper in Nature Climate Change. The article, of course, ignores acceleration of warming in the ocean, focusing instead on the well-known pause in land surface temperature since 1997. This despite a report from NOAA a week ago indicating ocean temperature is higher than it's ever been measured. Story in New Scientist includes this excerpt, quote, "The current hiatus will probably be followed by a rapid warming as the heat trapped in the ocean escapes back into the atmosphere." There's much more, but I've had too little time to plow through the information since my travels ended just a couple of hours ago, and we're out of time. Mike Walker writes at the Near Term Human Extinction Support Group, quote, "I'm having this experience that the more I embrace NTHE, the more I see ego in everything. Like it was once said, all is vanity. The neat thing about this experience is once I see the meaninglessness of it all, I begin to see more of the important stuff." And I couldn't agree more. Keep up with us at Nature Bats Last, on the air and on the internet. Join us on Facebook in various places. Keep up with the written version of Nature Bats Last at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and forthcoming events. And there and on Facebook, you'll find coming events on the Central California coast later this month. And next month, a trip to New Zealand, a New Zealand tour as well. After that, trips to Missouri and back to the Central California coast in time for the Earth at Risk conference. For now, that's it. A final parting shot from Pauline. As we've indicated many times, the dominant culture has been very clever. But you know what they say, Pauline?
Nature bats last.
There you go. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.
Mm-hmm.